Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Cult of Gracie Radio, broadcasting on XXBN via the Blog Talk Radio switchboard. Tonight, we have three lovely ladies with us. We have Dr. Jane Vargas, who most of listeners must be familiar with by now, and her two lovely grown daughters, Rebecca and Rachel. The two R names confused me, so I had to write down which one was for which site, because the site names are very similar, too. Rachel is the pop feminist, right? And Rebecca is with Porn Perspectives, correct?
That's correct.
I didn't even copy it wrong. Excellent. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Well, what I wanted to talk to you guys tonight about was this whole process of growing up with Jane as a mom, and not just to put her like on the hot coals or anything, but you all grew up with a mom who was clearly sex positive, clearly a feminist, clearly, you know, kind of out there in a relatively public way, dealing with issues that a lot of us, you know, were being told not to talk about, you know, around the dinner table kind of thing. So, and yet you ladies both grew up to be intelligent feminists. You deal with sexuality. You're both really well known for your writing, and not just because you talk about sex, but just for being articulate with the written word. And so you got your heads on straight, and you kind of debunked the great myth that children who hear about sex grow up to be damaged, crippled, insane people, especially if their mother admits to having sex and that sex is part of life, that, you know, you poor girls are supposed to have, you know, been institutionalized at the age of 12 or something, and that didn't happen. So I guess the first question is, I don't know if it would be fair to have, maybe it'd be more fair to have a daughter speak first about what their experience was growing up with Dr. Jane as a mom.
I think that's fine. Rebecca, do you want to take this one?
Sure.
Rebecca was older.
I was older.
She remains older.
I was 10 years old, and so Rachel was 8 when our mom started her business. And I guess she can give a little bit more of the exact history, but from my point of view, how it all came about was she and our dad divorced when I was 7 years old. Rachel was 5, and she worked in a horrible job with long hours, and we were fighting all the time. You know, she was never home. It was a very stressful situation. And she started this hobby business that dealt with fetish, and I'm now currently a management consultant, and I think the traits that have led me to this job were emerging at that time. And I actually got involved helping her organize her business. We like set up in the garage, basically, like creating audio fantasies. I would just help her like reproduce the tapes. I didn't ever listen to them. I didn't know what was on them, but I would help organize everything and like kind of create the assembly line to like create the actual materials that would get sent out to customers. It all seemed so normal to me. I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. This is like mom's business. I'm helping with it. And it became very successful, and she was able to quit her job and work from home, which helped with the family dynamics a lot. Just having a mom who was there, it didn't matter that she was there, you know, making porn. She was there. Like, that's what mattered. At that young age, before I even really had an understanding of what she was doing, it actually had a very positive impact on our lives because we had a mom who was around as opposed to a mom who was working 80 hours a week.
When did you find out that it was about the business of fetish, that it had to do with sexuality? How old do you think you were when that light bulb came on? And were you told directly, or had you just started, you know, piecing information together?
Do you remember mom ever like sitting us down and being like, "This is what I do"?
I don't ever remember that. I mean, it was always, I think that the knowledge just sort of came in by osmosis as we got older. I specifically remember, you know, back in the early days when there were still the erotic audio cassettes, and there were these pictures of models on the covers that were just like, they weren't naked. I mean, they were just
like pretty women.
They were just pictures of like headshots, in essence, of beautiful women. That, you know, okay, maybe there was a sultry look or something, or they were wearing a sort of revealing blouse or something. And I had a childhood best friend who was actually this really strict, I can remember, very strict Muslim family, and was never allowed really to go over to other people's houses in general, but she was there that time, and I remember giving her these pictures, like, oh, these beautiful pictures, I'm giving them, and Mom saw me do that and intervened, and then I was sort of aware at that moment, like, oh, wait, is there something wrong here? Is this not totally normal for everybody? And I must have been, I'd say, in second grade when that happened. So I guess that would be my awareness.
Yeah, I remember those pictures. We used to treat them almost like trading cards.
Yeah.
We collect them. We collect them, and we had, like, our favorite ones. I remember there was this blonde woman that we both thought was the prettiest.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd be like, oh, well, this is our favorite one. And, like, we have, like, the different array of cards. And there was always this material sort of around the house. It never was explicitly, like, okay, girls, here's what I do. I, you know, create these things for men, and you're not supposed to tell anyone about this. It was more just, yeah, whatever. This is what I do, and it's not even almost worth commenting on, but just don't mention it at school.
That was the key, and we ended up moving to a very kind of suburban nightmare kind of town that everyone knew everybody's business and whatever, and that's when it really coalesced that it was, okay, this is something that other people do not do and other people probably should not know about. And so at that point, we had to be like, I can't imagine, and Mom might be able to comment on this, but, you know, I'm wondering if you were stressed at all about having these, like, you know, fifth graders, like, trot off to school in this small town, like, not knowing if we were going to, you know, tell everybody what you did for a living. And in this particular community, that would have meant, you know, being ostracized.
Or having someone call Child Protective Services and say that our mother's exploiting us or
yeah.
some ridiculous thing like that. That was always a nagging concern, I think.
So, Jane, I guess the question to you is what, based on what the girls are recollecting, and they asked you specifically about the town you lived in, if you were worried about being exposed and what that might mean.
Well, I want to back up just a little bit. When I started this business, I was just turning 40, and I was working about 80 hours a week. I was the editor of a city magazine, and I had breakfast meetings and dinner meetings, and my kids were in before school care, after school care. I was a single mom, and our lives were just a nightmare. And it's interesting that when I took the plunge and made this ridiculous little hobby into my main focus, the whole household calmed down. We were all so much happier, even though we had extreme financial worries for the first year and a half to 2 years. It really made our lives so much better for me just to be around. And so that's the first thing. Another thing is that I remember Rachel in particular admired another mom who was a piano teacher, and she had this real long straight hair and wore gauze skirts, and she walked her kids to school in the mornings. And it wasn't about, you know, what I was doing, you know, with fetishism as much as that I wasn't a piano teacher, and she wanted me to be a piano teacher, and I was never a Birkenstock gauze skirt long hair piano teacher. I just wasn't ever going to be that no matter what I did. And so that was just a second thing I just remember. I was, when we moved to this community that was quite conservative, very upscale and small and closely knit, I was quite concerned that my new husband would be judged and that my kids would be judged. I wasn't so much worried about me being judged. I was just doing what I was doing and didn't worry about that. But I worried that it would hurt them, and I was concerned about them being so comfortable with it. And by that point, they were a little bit older, and it was actually, we talked about sexuality over the dinner table. I mean, it was becoming part of the family discussion about letters that I would get. I was starting to write my Dear Jane column for Leg Show magazine. And it was just kind of part of what we talked about. And yes, I was worried that I knew that that wasn't normally what people talked about or what people did. And yes, I was worried about the community knowing.
So
I remember when Real Sex did a segment on me. I'm thinking it was the very early 2000s. And our home was a large home on a corner, and the draperies didn't come all the way together. And I had to, and there were lots of camera crews and big trucks outside, and I had to kind of pin the draperies together so that people couldn't see inside. And then I had to worry about my mother-in-law coming over because she didn't know anything about it, or maybe it was a don't ask, don't tell situation. I don't even know what it was. But yeah, there were a lot of concerns around that business given the social mores of our community. I was always really proud of what I did, and I remember that when my girls would question it, I would say, someday you'll be proud of me because I actually do help people. And what I meant was that I helped people not get off, but feel and
well, that too, Mom.
That too, but what I realized doing my business was that men came to me thinking that that's what they wanted, was that they wanted a sexual relief, but what they really ultimately wanted was understanding and acceptance. And I was very comfortable giving that. I feel like we don't choose our fantasies, they choose us. And if a man wants to sniff women's shoes and that's how he becomes sexually aroused, he can't help that. And I had all the sympathy in the world for that. So whenever they did question it, I'd say, someday you'll be proud of me. Because what I do is really not good for people. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Well, let's get into some of those conversations with young our daughters, Rachel and Rebecca. At some point, there must have been, first there was an awareness that not everybody was into this or familiar with this. But at some point, especially, you turn 13, 14, and in our culture, teenage daughters are allowed to think their mother is the devil. And so there's this sort of separation that can be pretty explosive. So there must have been, at least around that time, some, if not awkwardness, some out-and-out, pure 100% embarrassment with what Mom did. Do you remember those points?
This is Rachel talking. I never really had a rebellious period. At all. I just always, principle of Mom's parenting style was that it was very free. I mean, in a way which we were treated like we were given respect. Well, we could do what we wanted with our time, and it was very liberal in that sense. So there was nothing really to rebel against. And I suppose more than anything, I had one friend who from this community that did know. She was over enough that there was no way to, there's just simply no way to hide it. And she was very impressed. And so in that sense, actually, it was a real source of pride and never embarrassment. I suppose the only time that I ever felt uncomfortable, and it's not, you can be as liberal as you want, seeing your mother in sexual, clothes or something occasionally when Mom would pose her photographs, or when she recorded the audio cassettes and she would sort of make her voice that sultry voice, I just kind of was like rolling my eyes like, Mom, and that kind of embarrassment, but never anything that really and it shocked me and made me feel bad about her. And this idea that mom, that you were just talking about, that we didn't like what you were doing, and you said that one day we'd be thankful. I think that that comes much, much more from our very early childhood, you know, when all children are kind of Puritans anyway. But as it came to our teenage years, I don't feel like I ever had, and possibly Rebecca more so, but she can speak on that. I never had a problem.
Yeah, I think that our, you know, I definitely, like, went through an early teenage, like, bratty, like, mom, you're so embarrassing, or whatever. But it was never about sexuality in particular. It was just general, like, mom, why are you wearing your hair like that, mom? Like, you know, I remember she was, like, she used to, well, I could get her to drop me off at school. She would, like, have curlers in her hair. This was, like, an everyday battle. I was like, mom, don't have curlers in your hair when you drop me off. And she would, like, insist on it. Like, don't wear those sweatpants. It's, you know, whatever. Not that she wears sweatpants for all those
listening.
Heaven, no. Heaven, no, never. She's a sultry seductress always. but, like, it was like that sort of embarrassment. It was not about her business in particular. And so, and like Rachel said, when we were older, it, especially so, maybe when I was really young, it was like, it was annoying to have to hide things. When my friends would come over, I remember I'd like run through the house and be and scream porn check, and we'd like hide all the porn because
I have a good anecdote that I want to share. We had in this house this is Rachel again, and this very picturesque sort of like ideal prom stairs. Like there was like a sort of what do you call it, a terrace or what is it? Just an open
like
a landing at the top, and then you can like curve down and go down the stairs, and then it goes right into the foyer. I don't know all these words. You know, just like the exact, like, you know, and then in an ideal prom moment, the date would be saying it's the corsage. But it just so happened that the day of my prom night, there was in the landing a filming happening that was like some sort of fetish film, and I don't really know what it was. But there was some, I do remember there was a man who was gagged with a ball, and like, just like, and so I get ready, and my date comes, this poor oblivious thing, and he's there standing so innocently with that corsage at the bottom of the stairs, and I come down with my prom dress and whatever. And meanwhile, there's this like hushed film crew in this very precarious position just off from the terrace so that he can't see it in his line of vision. And we do the whole, I mean, it's just this like total, you know, parody of the kind of chase, prom little suite.
Meanwhile, the man with the ball gag
out
in the corner.
I know, there's like half naked people upstairs in mid whip. But yeah, that, I mean, and that kind of thing, and it never embarrassed me. I always thought that was, you know, even in a way, it's like I almost didn't even think about it, you know, because ultimately, you know, what mom did for a living, you know, was as much as it impacted our lives, was just that she was around a lot, you know, and not to say that, you know, a mom that works outside of the house is a bad mom, but in our case, it really did happen to be, you know, very, you know, very nice to have her always around, and whatever she was doing was completely, you know, incidental.
Except when it interfered. I remember in high school and even afterwards in college when I'd come home for summers, she would often have, we had a very beautiful house when we moved to the upscale conservative community that we've talked about so much. We had a really nice house, and so it was often the set of some of her films. And it was way more cost effective to have the film crew and the actors stay in the house and then film there and everything. But it was so disruptive for me personally, because I was very uptight. I was a straight A student in high school, and this is Rebecca, by the way.
No, not me.
I was a straight A student in high school, and I just wanted to like do my homework and be left alone. And it was disruptive to have all these film crews and like, you know, porn being filmed in the next room. And so that was one thing that was bothersome to me about it. But that would have been true of, you know, anything that she did, you know, just bringing people into the house. It would have been disruptive, whatever they were doing.
Yeah, probably the most sort of, I mean, one of the most central things to my mind with what mom did for a living is just sort of the banality of it. But it was just sort of like in the sense that, okay, like there's one being filmed in the next room. I'm like, well, like all these people are annoying me. It's never like this like wet, big, Shazam, wow kind of thing just because you get used to it growing up. I think there's a shock people associate with sex. I mean, if that sort of relieved or dispelled early on, just like there being open communication and not being from a repressive household, you know, it never kind of intrudes upon your sensibilities in the way that I think it does for other people that might hear about it and make assumptions.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about the juxtaposition of the sweet, innocent prom boy at the corsage and just beyond his eyesight, like almost for a TV panning to the left, seeing the film crew. Were there moments like that where when you maybe were at a friend's house and you realized, you know, that I had friends growing up that, like, the last thing on earth their parents would discuss with them was sex. That's what I was, you know, I and the other friends were there for, to educate them. Were there any moments for you that were that same sort of stark contrast where you go to someone else's house and you realize, you know, this was, you weren't Kansas anymore. Now you were in this weird environment where you couldn't talk about things that were just very second nature at home.
I think, I don't know, I'm trying to remember. I mean, there were definite instances. I think that generally, Rachel speaking, I'm very verbose and I kind of tend to put my foot in my mouth a lot and just, you know, like going over to other people's houses, my friend's houses growing up. You know, it wasn't that I personally would talk about anything that mom was doing, but I just sort of was very liberal with my language and I was just very, you know, openly, I taught all my friends like various sexual vocabulary words and whatever. There were general households where I felt unwelcome because of that, although not mostly. But I think the piano teacher thing that mom brought up, this was a family that was in our neighborhood that the mom was a piano teacher. The dad was, he looked like Abraham Lincoln. And all I know is that he went around to different schools giving speeches as Abraham Lincoln. And their children were homeschooled. And they were these like amazing kids. And it was just sort of like almost like absurd, like, you know, kind of idyllic.
Wholesome
family, and I guess like I set up that contrast in my mind between our sheer depravity and fairy tale kind of household, that was probably the only time where I ever felt regret that mom wasn't this like June Cleaver type, but that's early childhood, and I do think that, you know, very young children sort of tend to be, for whatever strange reason, extremely Puritan and very, you know, kind of self-imposed repression, no matter what your parents sort of make available to you. At least that was the case with me. I don't know. Rebecca, do you want to continue?
Just back to Gracie's question about how it was going to other people's houses. I think I didn't. The whole sexual environment, the fact that sex was so normal in our house and there was porn everywhere, and it became, to me at least, just a total non-issue. Like, I didn't even, you know, it was like, you know, we have green towels at our house, you have blue towels at your house. It was just so not even a thing that I didn't really think about it. And I think that sort of continued throughout my life. Like, having come from a childhood where it was completely normal and accepted and not taboo at all. And in fact, to have your first exposure to sexual material be fetish makes it even more, you're not shocked by anything. Sex just has an impact on people, I think, where it's mere existence or mention of it. Just, you know, everyone just has this like very, I don't know, base kind of reaction to it where you're like, oh God, that's sex, oh my God. And I don't have that. I think I just wasn't built with it, or, you know, my childhood beat it out of me or something. I just don't get freaked out about those sorts of things. It has almost no effect on me. So when I go to someone's house my friend's houses, and it wasn't like that at all. They were, you know, very wholesome seeming and whatever. It just, yeah, It was like, well, I wish my mom would bake cookies with me. But it wasn't like, oh, God, you guys don't have sex here. Let me, you know, educate you or talk about it. Because it was a non-issue to me. I wasn't interested in talking about it.
Did you ever have a moment, as a even maybe in college or moving out, having some distance from, you know, that, you know, living at home to having your own place, where you had a little more of another context situation for yourself, where you realized that you were lucky to have had all this?
Absolutely. I'm so thankful.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. That's certainly true. This is Rachel again, when I got to college, I sort of discovered feminism, you know, in feminist literature, and, you know, I felt like I had such a unique perspective going into it, you know, and I never focused on porn in terms of feminism. I never focused on, you know, really rape or sexuality at all. I was much more into this kind of philosophical side of it. And I think that though when I would encounter that, and probably the reason I was less interested is because it seemed so matter of fact. It was just like, you know, it was put to rest for me just because these issues had always been sort of on the table my whole life. I had never really called them feminist issues, or I'd never conceived of mom as being a sex positive feminist. We never used those words growing up. But I think that it has given me a really useful perspective in my interest in feminism and my pursuit of feminist writing that kind of makes my mind much more open to what sex is and can do for men and women, and kind of taking the sort of darkness out of it that I feel so many feminists kind of come to it assuming, you know, and it completely shapes how they view sexuality and sex issues between men and women in a way that I think is very counterproductive, and I'm happily unhindered by it. And Rebecca, do you want to?
No, I agree.
Same.
My area of writing with my blog, and I wrote my undergraduate honors thesis about this topic as well, is the economic position of women in the pornography industry and how that's been evolving. And I think coming from firsthand experience from a very young age of seeing that porn is not necessarily exploitative, is not necessarily harmful, and actually can be an amazing agent of liberation and freedom for women, as I saw it was for my mom. I think that background just help, like Rachel said, just calm down a lot of those kind of knee-jerk reactions that you almost inevitably have, you know, as you go through your education and you learn about feminism and problems in the world. And so I think it gave me a good foundation to start my writing from. And I understand that not everyone has this experience that our mother had, but knowing that that experience is possible can put to rest a lot of the objections that porn is necessarily exploitative or objectifying, if that's even a bad thing.
So I have to imagine right now that your mom is sitting there with little bits of tears in her eyes. I mean, she has to be so proud of you, but she must also, Jane, you have to feel, I mean, I feel it, an incredible, I mean, what a gift you gave your daughters and that they realize that. That's really powerful.
The one reason I was never much of a disciplinarian with them is because I always felt about my children that they were a gift to me, that I got to enjoy them in my home for 18 years, and I get to have them. They weren't little bundles of clay for me to mold or create into the human beings I wanted them to be. I knew that they were their own human beings, and I loved watching them grow. I just love watching them today. And they're talking to you from Warsaw at 4 in the morning there. And it's because they're open and they're adventuresome. And Rebecca has worked there, and Rachel took some time off to go visit her. And I'm just so proud of them. And a couple of small things that I'm sure never happened in other families are things like sitting around watching, I think it was Tu Wong Fu with Love from Julie Newmar, where Patrick Swayze is cross-dressed and he drives by his family home, and he has, you know, sadness because his he can't knock on the door, he can't be part of the family, and it was so sad. And Rachel was just a little girl, and she piped up, "That's so sad. My mom would be proud of him." That made me so happy. It made me so proud that, you know, they were just, the both of them were just open to possibility in life, just not only on a sexual frontier, in the sexual frontier, but on any frontier. They're just open to possibility. What is there in life? And as you can see, they're seizing life.
Yeah, well, I have to take the usual moment here to say that you're listening to Cult of Gracie on XXN, broadcasting via Blog Talk Radio Network. I wanted to open the phone lines officially in a few minutes, but one of the questions I had, I would shoot myself if I didn't get to, was this issue of body image. It's difficult enough, just any girl growing up feeling good in her own skin, but when you're talking about, you know, trading pictures of pretty girls from your mom's collection of models like trading cards, obviously your ideas of beauty and what that meant, you know, that had to be heightened a bit. So I wanted to ask both you girls what your thoughts were on body image and that sort of thing growing up and now.
Okay, I'll take this first. This is Rebecca. I really don't think that having that sort of material around had any impact one way or the other on my body image. I think I had the normal body image issues of any young girl growing up. And I am always really confused when women try to posit that pornography impacts their body image or makes them feel less good, because it's a picture. It's, you know, I like Camille Paglia always said, what's it to you? Like, a beautiful woman's a great thing. Like, you're not going to, I mean, it's absurd to look at a picture of a beautiful model and then go home and cry to yourself that you don't look like her. It's just appreciated. It's an aesthetic joy in life. And I obviously didn't have that sort of view when I was young, but it never crossed my mind to compare myself to them, because I'm not one of the women in, you know, the magazine or on the trading card.
Well, I'm of the opinion that we give, you know, we use the media, capital P, capital M, and we blame that for, you know, as women, we say that the media has given us this image of unrealistic beauty. I'm 44 years old, so I've come back around to this where I was in my, you know, early 20s, and I sort of started to agree with that. And then I got to this position now where I go, you know, I think that any woman that looks at a picture, whether it's to sell me makeup or a car or happens to be on the screen for whatever reason, if I think that that message is I'm supposed to look like her, I'm pretty much made out of, you know, nothing. I have no opinion of my own. I am out buying the car and buying the soap and the pantyhose, because I just feel like it's, you know, we use the most beautiful women, and quite often they are literally technically freaks, and I mean that in the artistic sense of the word, where they are this very small percentage of us who have these certain features, and so that naturally they become the art, they become the beauty, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the standard that if we don't meet, we are failures at.
Right. And I think, I mean, also, I mean, the kind of images, as Rachel talking, the images that you're talking about are often images that are shaped by gay men, you know, who really control the fashion industry much more than heterosexual. I mean, heterosexual sexuality, in a way, you know, and I would hypothesize that being exposed to pornographic images of women that tend more or less to appeal to heterosexual male sexuality, you see a larger range of bodies that are acceptable and sound sexually attractive, And
if especially as you get into fetish, I think
right.
that's a more authentic expression.
Exactly. That thing, when I see, a model on a runway, to my mind, I'm like, well, you know, God, she would be a failure in porn.
No one would want to.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel that, having grown up and sort of seeing images of women, that do not look like models, but that are presented to me as a child and all growing up as desirable women sexually, and always, never, and the word objectified is just so, it's so vague and just, a dull way to talk about, sexuality in any way. But, the way that mom treats these women and frames them, it's certainly not objectified and does not demean them in any way, and it just celebrates their power, which I think growing up, I always had a sense, along with those typical body image issues, I always had a sense that I was sexually powerful in a way that I think I've been a lot healthier about my body than most of my peers.
Do you think meeting the models and knowing that they were real people and, they stayed at your house and maybe you saw one cry or get angry or be mad at herself or something, and you saw, a full actual human being instead of just a photo, that helped round out your image that they were just people?
Yeah, I suppose.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it definitely, I just think that I almost can't even fathom what people must think about our family. No matter how much we talk about it, there's just a set of assumptions about what pornography means that everybody sort of has, and I think that we've had such a unique experience with that. There's no way to know, to me, I look at the pornography industry and I immediately see people and human beings, and, there's different kinds of pornography, of course. The kind that mom does in fetish pornography, I think there is a human element that we bring, that we see. But I would wonder if any woman would, just seeing seeing your erotica, there's just a human component that we have. And I can't comment on if that comes from knowing these women personally or just seeing erotic material as a very rich and human experience that is, very unfortunately repressed in most people's lives.
Go ahead, Jane.
I was going to say that my own body image has been affected a tremendous amount through the exploration of fetishism, because I have learned so completely and thoroughly that connecting with the mind is so much more powerful than connecting with the body. I would go toe-to-toe with any beautiful 20-year-old in a room with a man, and I'm 55, and give us an hour with him, and he will want to go to bed with me more than he'll want to go to bed with the 20-year-old. And it's because men respond to the richness of a woman's mind and her understanding of what is sexual, what is sexy. There's a quote that I read of Paris Hilton's, where she said, my boyfriend says that I am sexy but not sexual. And that is such a huge difference. To be sexy isn't necessarily to be sexual, and what is to be sexual isn't really taught to women. We just see images of what's sexy, but we don't really have an understanding of what is sexual or what is truly appealing about a person in a sexual sense.
Yeah, not only about ourselves, but also about what another person sees or wants.
Right,
we don't
exactly.
see it in ourselves, we don't see it in a potential partner. We have a question in the chat room from Greg H. Would Jane change anything if she could go back in time?
Hmm.
And I'm assuming this was question was typed out quite earlier when we were discussing the raising of younger girls, so.
I would change a lot of small things. Times I became angry with my daughters that was not warranted, that came from the frustration of, just the situation in life where I was trying to start this business and we didn't have enough money and it was very, very, very stressful. And I remember blowing up a couple of times in just sheer frustration and anger and that kind of thing. I would, oh gosh, if I could take those back, I would in a second.
And girls, anything from you that you would, if you could go back and change, you would change?
I don't know. I mean, I guess, Rebecca had a little more contention.
I think, yeah, I mean, I wish I'd fought less with my mom and stuff, things like that. I wish that I had gotten actually more involved in what she was doing. I mean, I know I said that, you know, as like a 10-year-old kid, I was helping her manufacture cassette tapes and send them off. But after that, I really just kind of got involved in school and in my life. And her business just became an inconvenience to me. And it just got in the way of me getting A's and whatever, which is such a lame attitude to have about it, I think. And I wish I had been less lame. And I wish I had, there were times when she, I think it was when you were doing the real sex thing, Mom, that you put me up at the Marriott Hotel across the highway because I think we wanted, maybe it wasn't the real sex. It must have been a film that you had made. Anyway, so you wanted people to stay at the house, and it was less expensive to get one hotel room for me and then have, you know, all these people stay in the house as opposed to getting separate rooms for everyone. I was staying at the Marriott Hotel, and my journalism advisor, I was editor of the paper, he called the house, and Rachel answered. She was a gopher on the set. So she answered the phone, and she was like, oh, yeah, Rebecca, she's at the Marriott. Here's the number. And so I get a call. I was like 16 years old. I get a call from my teacher, and he's like, why are you at the Marriott? And I was like, I don't know. I'll tell you when I graduate. Trust me, it's fine. Everything's okay. But like, that's an example of a situation where I extracted myself from what she was doing because I just wanted peace and quiet to do my work instead of like what Rachel did, where instead of volunteering to like help out on the set and like actually see what was going on, it was just annoying to me and I didn't want to deal with it. But I wish I had more.
Well, there are worse things to complain about, you guys. It almost sounds idyllic. I'm gonna officially open the phone lines in case anyone is bravely willing to come on air with three such incredible women. The number is 646-200-3136. Again, that's 646-200-3136. Or if you are phone phobic, not that you should be, but if you are, you can type a question into the chat room. Again, I'm unable to reply there, but I will keep my eyes there and look for any questions posted.
This is Jane. My thought just flew right out of my head. I'm sorry. Go ahead. And
well, I'm overall so impressed because, I know that, like you said, other people are so fascinated and have assumptions or images in their mind of what it must be like. Which is probably pretty far removed from your experience, but it is still rather fascinating because there's sort of this blasé attitude about it, which I think it was Rachel that said that, you know, she got to feminist school and she was so much further past that stuff because she'd already seen that it was possible, but she didn't need to debate or argue that anymore. And so there was a lot of things that you learned there, but there was no epiphany light bulb moments for you.
I think that when you grow up with something, it's just part of what your life is. There's nothing to have an epiphany about when it's just around you. I mean, we actually discussed things over dinner. I remember very clearly one of the girls, I
believe it was you, Rachel, who announced at dinner one night that you'd really be, you were in high school, you'd really be okay if you learned that a boy you were dating had a fetish as long as it wasn't the tampon fetish that we had discussed.
You and I have boundaries.
I think that one thing that anybody, this is what flew out of my head before, that anybody would wonder about growing up with sexuality around is, did Rebecca and Rachel become sexual at an early age? Or was there promiscuity with me, with them, with, I mean, how depraved, I mean, they've used the word depraved a couple of times, but how depraved was it, really?
Is that a question thrown to us? By our mother. By our mother.
Mom's going to use on-air experience as a chance to tell you when you lost your virginity.
I'll tell you one thing that happened when Rachel was in high school that I thought was really interesting. Rachel went through a 50s stage where she wore very 50s clothes, and her skin is very, very pale, and she wore striking blood red lipstick, and she wore these dresses with cinched waists and high, high heels and stuff. And I remember her telling me when she got home from school one day that there was a boy blocking the door and to get into a class, and he was like tormenting girls. Rachel, do you remember? Do you know what I'm talking about? And when you
I have no idea what you're talking about.
When you came along, I know these girls always talk about how I have false memories, but I swear to God, this is true. You talked about Rachel. When you came up to the door, he stepped aside and let you in, like kind of with a flourish. But other girls, he was just tormenting and not treating with respect. But with you, he treated you like a lady.
Well, I'm not sure that that happened, but I know what you are generally speaking. Maybe the images, there's a lot of pin-up art around our house, and I just sort of saw that as that the way in which one would become beautiful would be to look like the pin-up women, you know, and not like, you know, the girls on Dawson's Creek or whatever. And I think that actually, what that did do, I think it made my sexual experience in high school, I guess, a little less awkward. I think that there was like a very, I never feel like I went through this phase where I wasn't sure how to manage my body. You know, I always was aware of the sexual power of women's bodies, and in a way that, you know, you see these girls going around and like their, you know, cleavage is hanging out and their pants are really low and they just sort of look like slutty, and they don't look, I mean, they clearly don't understand how to be sexual in a way that is empowering. And how to manage their bodies appropriately, knowing that people respond, you know, negatively or positively to that kind of display. And I think that, when I was a teenager growing up, that was never an issue. And I think that it always sort of, I can't say that there was like any kind of like sexual element to it, but I think that my teachers responded to me differently. I think my peers responded to me differently. Being sexually mature when you're a woman, it kind of can stand in for maturity in general. I don't know how mature I was, you know, at that age, but I think that I was regarded as extremely mature because of that fact, you know, that you can be sexual looking as a teenager and also not do so, not be vulgar about it, I suppose.
Or to, like, construct your idea of what is sexy at a young age, as opposed to buying into some mass culture Girls Gone Wild.
Right, exactly.
I think that to get back to our mother's question about her virginity or whatever, I mean, she knows, like, we've all talked about it, but I think both Rachel and I were very late to become sexually active. I mean, not like incredibly, but I think the average is like 16, and we were later than that. And I think part of the reason is because we just didn't need to use sex as a way of rebelling against our mom or being shocking, because when you have dinner table conversations about sex every day, it's just not going to be that interesting to you as a mode of rebellion to go have sex or do something sexual. Plus, it was really demystified because it was...
I would like to say that mm-hmm. from an outsider's point of view, that what you guys learned was not just, you know, control of your own body and understanding that what sexuality was as opposed to just being sexy, but that you also knew and had learned that there was a responsibility component with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
It's true. Yeah, it's definitely true. And
I think responsibility and the specialness of it, and that not just anybody is worthy of us. I think that's huge. I saw that with my girls. I still see it. I mean, so-and-so just isn't worthy of me, period. You know, just how special we are. And it's not we ourselves, Rebecca, Rachel, and Jane, although it is that too, but it's what I'm talking about is that specialness of being a woman and understanding, like Rachel said, how to be sexual in a way that's empowering and really embracing your sexual power. It's huge, because then you don't need to be at all promiscuous in order to feel sexually viable or sexually powerful. In fact, that doesn't work. I remember asking one of the girl's friends at school who talked to me about sex. I can't even remember her name, but she said something like, I said, oh, you're sexual, because I knew my girls weren't yet. And how does that work for you, or why are you sexual? Because it seemed like she was really not comfortable with it, and she said, I'm sexual so that the boys will like me. And I said, well, do the boys like you? And she said, well, just for sex. So she wasn't even getting what she wanted. She wanted the boys to like her. But it was just so excited.
I don't think you can really be self-aware and not have self-respect. You know, and
right.
demand that others stand behind that line until you, you know, call their number, you know, it's sort of like, you know, no, this is the boundary.
Right, exactly.
We only have about 7 minutes left, and there's one other question I want to get to since we're kind of nosing around here. I will just say that if we go a little over to the listeners, the show will be recorded in full, but if it stops streaming, just come back in about a half an hour to an hour, and you can download the entire show, just in case we go over here. I'm in my 40s, and one of the things I've noticed with what they call this, you know, third wave feminist movement here, which I affectionately call my 20-year-old sisters, it seems to me that a lot of them have mistaken sexual positivity or sexual equality with sexual promiscuity. And I say this with not out of a laying a blame or calling them, you know, sluts, but just out of this misidentified sense of power. You've talked about empowerment, girls, and your mom has talked about this self-knowledge and respect here. You see that with a lot of women your own age, that they just don't have those lines for themselves, that they think that going out and acting like a guy is the same thing as what you're doing?
I don't know. I think, I can't speak on Rebecca's behalf, but, you know, I'm never really around girls that would identify as third wave feminists, that do make that mistake. I think, you know, where I live and the kinds of people I talk to, generally I think third wave feminism has been extremely positive for women's sexuality. I think that what you're referring to is this sort of girl gone wild sort of thing that I guess it could be an offshoot of the third wave which is valid. I mean, if they call that feminism, you know, far be it from me to say that they're wrong, but it's always hard to know, you know, what people find empowering. So, for example, if a woman flashes her breasts on camera on one of these things, and she comes from a very repressed household or something, and that actually could be a very genuine moment of liberation for her in a way that it would just never be for me, because, like, what would I be liberating myself from? And I think that in that sense, it's sort of really hard to sort of, like, cast our eyes upon certain kinds of promiscuity as not liberating versus, you know, a more, you know, mature sexuality or whatever it is. And that's also not to say that promiscuity is in and of itself bad. And a lot of times, you know, some of the more interesting feminine, what are you just trying to
say? I want to talk.
Oh, okay. all right, I'm going to shut up. Rebecca, do you want to interject?
This is Rebecca. I have a lot to say on this topic. I'll try to keep it brief. But I disagree with Rachel. I think that a lot of women our age, and we're both in our early 20s, a lot of women our age see feminism and, you know, look at feminist ideas and think that by being sexual, they are being feminist because feminists, you know, reclaim their sexuality and they don't care. They don't live by repressive societal mores and so on. And I agree with Rachel in that, yeah, sometimes that is really, that's what the person needs to do and that's good for them. But I think more often it's this, like, wholesale message that's, like, served to them. It's like, oh, you want to be a liberated woman? Then you should, you know, sleep around because that's what liberated women do. They don't care. And so they do it, and it doesn't make them feel any better. And I disagree so intensely with that kind of behavior. I think it is so harmful. I think it is not getting us anywhere. It's basically giving men, you know, sex and, like, not getting anything back and not demanding respect.
I don't know. I mean,
if you look at all these Girls Gone Wild videos and look at, women that I know that I work with and that I've gone to school with, they watch Sex and the City and they're like, I want to be like Samantha. I said, why do you want to be like that? I mean, fine, if you're naturally a Samantha type, fine. But as an aspiration, like, I want to have sex and not care. Like,
right?
How is that something that's going to make you, like, a better person or feel better?
Well, I mean, I would counter that by saying that you're thinking about sex very two-dimensionally. Like, I think that even if you're having casual sex, you learn things about yourself and about other people and about human interaction. And so very complex is never just, like, you know, I mean, unless you're having sex with the exact same kind of person, the exact same sort of situation, the exact same, you know, series of events unfold, like, there is a learning process, there is an enriching experience. You know, there have been periods where I've been more promiscuous, and there's been periods where I've been less so, and I think that, like, you know, being, one would hope that these women, if they are going to be promiscuous, and I have no judgment on that, whatever, and being on Girls Gone Wild or any of that stuff, absolutely. It's just to be sure that along with being sold this idea that to be feminist or to be liberated is to be sexually promiscuous, that there is a sort of, like, mature human understanding of what you actually also want. And I think that that's where, you kind of coming back to parenting, that's where, you know, no matter who your mom is or what she does or dad or moms or dads or whatever, no matter who the people are that raise you, instilling a sense of self, I mean, this third wave feminism, Girls Gone Wild, all this stuff can never be the scapegoat for, like, the basic sort of self-knowledge that a parent needs to impart to their child, however it happens. And, you know, it's totally irrelevant that mom did what she did for a living in that regard, because she did just as a human being to her two human adult, or not adult, rather, sorry, the two human children, is give them a real strong sense of self, completely unconnected to sexuality, but that would inform their sex lives later on, as it has for us.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I guess what I see is, and I'm, you know, promiscuity of capital P here is this sort of notion that you almost have to be, or that it's the only form of expression to really show your liberation. You know, like this Samantha sort of thing. Sex without caring. I'm not saying that there can't be recreational sex, and Lord knows, as a former escort, there's no way I could get away with saying that. But there is also, you know, a huge part of escort work and a huge part of what your mom's work was about, is connecting the emotional to the physical. And I see a lot of young women trying really hard to pretend that there isn't an emotional connection with these acts, whether it's they're not being honest about what they want, or they're pretending or projecting onto another person that, that they don't want a connection, so I don't want one either. But I sort of see a lot of this disconnect, and it almost is a shirking of responsibility, not necessarily in the safe sex ways, but in the emotional components of sex, that it's sort of saying, you know, this doesn't mean anything. And sex does mean something, even if it's just you learning about yourself. And I just worry about a lot of younger women, and when I hear from you two, it's quite clear that that you know that there are distinctions there.
Yeah. No, I agree completely with what you're saying. This is Rebecca. And I also am really concerned, you know, coming from that demographic, I am really concerned about my peers, honestly.
I mean, I just sort of, in a way, I'm all for radical subjectivity, so.
No, I have no problem with promiscuity. I think it's important for people to all go through a slutty phase. Like, you need to, like, do that. But like Gracie said, I think you have to understand, you know, the emotional component. And even if it's a lack of emotional component, where you're like, I'm really just going to have a one-night stand. That's what I want to do. That's fine. But to do it sort of without thinking and without, like, understanding what it means.
Right.
The problem. And I think I see people do that. I see my friends, my people I work with.
Okay.
It bothers me.
Okay, and I actually do, like, I'm getting what you guys are saying, and that's true. I think that one problem of this feminist notion that there is, we're trying to kind of diminish the distinction between men and women, and which is a distinction that should be diminished, but not all the way to the point of complete equity. There is, of course, a difference between men and women, and wanting, from a feminist perspective, for there to be no difference so as to support, you know, larger political implications of equality, that's done a disservice to women, I think. I think that sexually speaking, it's very important that feminists and feminists, you know, academically, politically, and also in popular culture, make sure that distinction is, and on one hand, not women are not on the losing end of that distinction, but they're also aware that they don't have to be like men to be open about their sexuality, and in fact, most of them can't be like men. And I would, you know, and that might be a controversial statement to some people, but from my own experience and my perspective, women do bring an emotional need to sex more often, maybe not all the time, but certainly more often than I believe men do. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that problem that I think that women our age now are grappling with sits on the shoulders of